So when I saw the scriptures that were assigned for August the 17th, I inwardly groaned. Not very promising for our coming service on the beach. Not very edifying to hear about people being sawn in two. Not very calming to hear Jesus say, "I came to bring fire to the earth, and how I wish it were already kindled." Especially in fire season. It's kind of tough to hear those words. "Do you think I have come to bring peace to the earth?" No, but I tell you, division. But as we've been following Jesus on his 10-chapter ramble towards Jerusalem, at least according to the Gospel of Luke, we've been encouraged to see that the issues Jesus is addressing are the real issues and difficulties of life, then and now. Issues of commitment, possessions, anxiety, the heart of prayer. And each time I've discovered not a forced overlap and relevancy, but genuine connection to our time and place. Now, whether you agree with me or not is quite another matter, of course, and we can have discussion about that. As Jesus travels and encounters people in the villages on his way to Jerusalem, his words have been alluding to something bubbling away under the surface. A national crisis is brewing, a toxic slew of unrest, oppressive taxes, and corruption is leading Israel closer and closer to her greatest stupidity. That will lead to her ruin, challenging Rome militarily. The binary of violently opposing or cravenly collaborating with the day's politics is seen by Jesus clear-eyed as destructive. Both will lead Israel astray. And so, we could say, mutatis mutandum, something like that. So yes, the modern world. And so Jesus can't help but be a lightning rod, a dividing point, and a massive disappointment to those who want economic uplift, freedom from immediate oppression, and the like. In our day, if Jesus doesn't have the immediate answer to climate change, to the wars that are raging around us, and the state of our politics, of what use is he, we wonder? To be sure, Jesus the idea seems more out there, social media, in the news than ever. The idea of Jesus is co-opted by the right and by the left and by the center, even. To be sure, the idea of Jesus is as malleable to whatever politics and economics is all the rage. But still, then till now, Jesus patiently, or in the case of today's reading, impatiently pines, impatiently calls for the beginning of the new age, the way he himself is making possible in his risen deity. The division that he brings, and Jesus is if nothing else, a master of hyperbole. Better, I think, to say the division that he makes known, that he exposes, even in families and in society at large, and we would say even in the church, the division that he exposes is the division between those who are interested in using human power and technology and smarts to enforce the privileges of the status quo for whomever is presently enjoying them, or for those who want to join that party, or be let in on it. And those always a much smaller minority who are beginning to see the world whole, who are beginning to see that human ingenuity is not the ultimate answer and is useful only as it serves the wider world. This same much smaller minority is not only interested in understanding this, but is interested in living differently, in a new partnership with God that refuses binaries, that refuses cynicism, and begins to take more risks with the gifts God has given to us. This is my contemporary reading, if you will, of Jesus' critique of human hypocrisy, in which we know, as he says, how to interpret the appearance of earth and sky, but refuse to interpret the present time. Jesus is getting at our phenomenal capacity that we have to infer, to make predictions, to interpret upon appearance, that is, data. We know, for instance, where the human-caused warming of the planet will lead us. We can infer this. We have pretty good models. And this has all been made more and more probable, at least our models, by the creation of another tool, a more powerful tool of our tool-making brains, probably the most powerful tool we've ever concocted, AI. And yet we refuse, as a species, to interpret the present time. And note, Jesus doesn't tell us this to make us ashamed, to judge us. Rather, everything he reveals, he does because the possibilities for our partnership are endless. He's making it so. It's not that we're doomed to be brain smart and soul stupid. That is, we're not doomed to be mired always in immediate self-interest. We are called into a partnership with the divine presence in which wisdom, genuine divine wisdom, is possible. Not for nothing did God say when we were created that we are the image of God, male and female. Not for nothing has Christ come to redeem, to save the world. Not for nothing has the Spirit that underlies and animates all life breathed into our souls at our baptism a profound partnership with God and with Christ. In times like these, when the world is burning politically, economically, and now almost literally, how do we live? The past holds some clues. At the fall of Rome in the early 5th century, at a time when the economics of the entire Roman Empire collapsed, 90% of GDP in the wider Mediterranean area was lost in a matter of decades. But this wasn't the end, because Christians realized that now it was time to unleash creativity. What the historians call the Dark Ages was in fact the time when new ways of living together, new economic models, and new types of community were created. What emerged out of this so-called Dark Age was a new age that resisted the older binaries. Of course, it introduced new ones. It ushered in a new age of exploration, a new age of artistic expression, a new sense that humanity had had too narrow of a vision, and that the process of understanding God and thus our place in the world was just actually beginning. They referred to themselves as the Middle Age. This isn't something that we invented as historical creatures looking back, they saw this clear-eyed. In the crisis we now face, I believe, because of Christ, a new creativity will and is indeed being unleashed. Most of us will not see its full fruition, but we can still participate in it, even if by way of anticipation, if you will. Most of us here live in nice neighborhoods, get to experience seascapes, as some of us in this parish will in just a few minutes. Most of us have our basic needs met, but we're also committed, which is why I think we're here this morning, to becoming not just smarter, but more spiritually in tune, wiser, if you will. This realization, this commitment that we have, that resists the binaries of violence and collaboration, resists right and left, are not, and resists them because we begin to understand that if we partner with God, all of this is passing away. There's new possibilities ahead of us, and that births hope. And it is that kind of hope that will lead us away from the temptations toward anxiety and greed and help us to see new ways of learning and serving. In Learning in Wartime, a chapel address delivered at Oxford University right before the advent of World War II, C.S. Lewis posed a question about studying art, literature, math, and biology. Well, war raged, or was about to rage. Why should we, indeed, how can we, continue to take an interest in these placid occupations when the lives of our friends and the liberties of Europe are in the balance? That was his question. And his answer was, life has never been normal. Human life has always lived on the edge of a precipice, full of crises, alarms, difficulties, emergencies. And yet we are called to carry on learning, becoming wiser. Still the dishes must be done. Still the teenager's questions must be answered. Still we must vote, advocate, paint, write, suffer, and rejoice. Still, Christ is here with us, undaunted, though he pines for the world to see what he offers. Amen.